Hey there, folks. Super excited for this interview that we're going to get into here in just a minute. Just want to give you a little bit of a warning that the audio is a little more scuffed than we'd like because Squadcast decided to give us a little bit of a fight. So we spent the better part of a little bit coming to get this to kind of the point that it's in. Hope that you really like the interview as well. In the future, I'd say by next week, we'll also have the video version of this out and up on YouTube. Because there are a couple of different visual elements. Joel shows us some art directly from the Devils, some of the original prints and paintings. So, very excited for this interview with Joel. Welcome to Words and Whiskey Short Pours, our podcast where we have a fun time discussing fictional worlds and the people that create them, all while boozing just a little bit. My name is Cross, and I am joined today by the indelible artist and one of the brain children behind the immersive merch company Lit Escalates, Joel Daniel Phillips. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm super stoked to have you. We've talked on and off over the course of a couple of different years through, you know, some of the different merch drops that the company has done. But I would love to chat with you just a little bit about you, the background, and what brings you here.
Absolutely. Looking forward to telling you everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would love to know and maybe give the people a little introduction to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a visual artist by trade. I started out in college actually studying graphic design and kind of stumbled backwards my junior year into drawing portraiture. I was doing this program in New York City. It was this off-campus program that I went on because I had an internship assigned to it, and I was really excited about it. And there was much more of a fine arts focus than I thought there would be. And so I showed up, and suddenly I was being asked to make fine art as part of this program. And I'd never really done much of that before. Mm-hmm. And I was just sort of messing around. I was literally doing things like dipping tea bags in paint and throwing them at a wall and all sorts of just ridiculous stuff. And one day a friend of mine showed up at the studio with a jar of charcoal pencils that she had left over from an illustration class. She was like, "Hey, maybe you should try drawing. I don't know, it could be fun." And I ended up sitting down and making this portrait of this man that I'd met while traveling that summer in Africa. And I remember I sat down and I started drawing, and it was probably like 7 o'clock at night, and I didn't get up from the chair until the sun was coming up. And
wow.
I just was like so fully enveloped in the process, and I made a horrible drawing. It was absolutely terrible, but I loved the process so much that I remember I got up from the chair and I went down to the street. It was in Midtown Manhattan, and I bought a bagel and a cup of coffee, and I went up on the roof of the building. I watched the sunrise, and I was like, "Well, shit, I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm studying graphic design, and I want to be a fine artist." And so that led me into the next several years, where I graduated, I finished my degree, didn't have time to change anything, and I basically started spending every spare moment I had drawing people around me. And I had to teach myself how to draw. It was absolutely terrible at first. But within a few years of graduating, I was actually able to quit my day job as a graphic designer and to focus fully on my fine art practice, which was at the time making large scale portraits of people on my street corner. So that was, gosh, that was a while back. That was, I think, 2013 was when I quit my day job. So yeah, it was kind of a funny beginning to the whole process because I certainly didn't plan for it. I wasn't one of those kids who is like, "I'm an art kid," you know.
Yeah.
Sports, and I don't know, I didn't really have that focus. So yeah, it was one of those things where, you know, I think you can get really lucky sometimes when you find something that you connect with so deeply. I know a lot of people don't necessarily have that connection to what they do with for their work. And yeah, I happened to sort of stumble on it, and it's got me hook, line, and sinker still.
To this day, yeah.
Yep.
It's incredible to see and to have also like charted your career over this last week of like digging into sort of the history. And I'm curious, for you and your path, are there any memorable like early works that you've hung on to or that you like personally treasure, you know, maybe like a breaking point or similar to the portrait that you were describing earlier? Anything that felt critical to you on your journey?
Turning points. I haven't hung on to much, to be honest. I've always been a little bit I've sort of walked the line between, you know, starving artist and also a little bit, I think, mercenary in my process, in that, you know, I make a piece and my goal is to, you know, always have it find a home. And luckily over the years, most of the work that I made has, you know, found homes in, you know, private collections and now institutions and things like that. So yeah, I don't actually have much, you know, in my collection from especially that first, you know, 5 years. Almost everything is sold. At this point, I try to hold on to things here and there, but it's hard. It's, you know, I really do want it to be out in the world. And so, you know, the idea of just me having it in my house feels a little silly. I'm almost like ready to let go most of the time. I'm ready to see it somewhere else because I spent so much time with it. You know, I'd almost rather it be somewhere else. But then you look back and I'm like, oh man, 10 years ago, like I kind of wish I kept a couple pieces, you know. But yeah, it's funny how that works. You don't, in the moment, you're like, well, I need to pay the rent, so I'm selling this drawing. So yeah.
I'm totally with that. Is there any memory that you've hung on to as a part of that? Like any creative piece that kind of like broke for you that you remember, not necessarily that you've hung on to fully, but
yeah, that's like kind of a turning
point.
A couple of them. My senior thesis project in college really was very much a turning point for me as an individual. It was actually a set of four portraits.
Read my mind.
One of my uncle, one of my brother, and one of me. And it was sort of me. It's actually very much my way of telling my dad, who was kind of terrified of the idea of me becoming an artist, because, you know, how are you going to pay the rent? That's what I needed to do. And so it was this set of portraits of... Basically, my brother is actually, he's a lawyer. He followed in my dad's footsteps. And my uncle is kind of this poet, musician, creative, all jack of all trades type. And it was kind of me saying, I'm going this direction. And my brother was moving this direction. And yeah, that piece was very much a turning point because it was about that sort of decision to pursue this thing, you know, despite at the time a lot of, you know, pushback from my family. But they've since very much come around to the idea of me being a chaotic creative person that I am.
Yeah, I mean, it's worked out. I mean, those are the bets and gambles, you know, that you have to take early on. And that's basically such a profound statement about the direction that you were going to head in the moment. So I particularly appreciated that one. I personally had a very selfish question, I think, on the rest of this list of like any other reflection that you've done on that piece. You know, like, is there anything that's changed for you, or how do you look back on that piece?
You know, it's interesting. So I remember at the time, because I was studying graphic design, and there was actually this like funny phone call I had with my dad, where during college, I actually called my dad up and I was like, I was thinking about, you know, doing the fine art thing and shifting. And he was like, he basically said, I'm not going to help pay for school if that happens, because I don't think that's a worthwhile sort of monetary investment, because how are you going to make a living? And I was at this sort of fancy private liberal arts school. And so I ended up, the reason I ended up studying graphic design is because it was sort of a compromise, you know, between him and me, where I was like creative, but also, you know, had, you know, very much a career potential. And when I made that piece, you know, that was very much about me telling my dad, I'm going to do this anyway. But I'm actually so thankful that he did push me to spend that time in college studying graphic design, because it's been very much like one of the most useful, you know, backgrounds to any creative practice. You know, it's paid its dividends in so many different ways. I mean, I would have never ended up doing anything for the Red Rising world if I hadn't also had this background in graphic design. I would have never launched Lit Escalates. I would have never been able to build my own website or market my own work in the way that I've been able to on the fine art side. There's been so many pieces to it that were really important. And so it's funny to think back on the person I was in that moment where I was telling my dad, I'm going to be an artist. And, you know, because, you know, in a lot of ways he was right, you know, in that this was a much more practical use of that, you know, investment of specific, you know, time studying. And I'm so thankful that, you know, he pushed me to do that. So yeah, it's funny. You know, when you're a kid, you're sort of like, I'll do whatever I want. You can't make me, you know, you can't make me not be who I am. And, you know, I very much am a painter, but having that practical underpinning and, you know, it not only allowed me to like have a job when I graduated, and then, you know, as I slowly transitioned into fine art, I still did design work on the side for a long time. But then it also just It taught me a lot about marketing and about sales and about thinking about the creative process from a viewer and a consumer standpoint, not just like, oh, what do I want to paint, you know, but more thinking about like, you know, how would an audience respond to this? And what's the market for this? And, you know, yeah, which is something that a lot of artists, I think, struggle with, you know, because art is a very solitary, almost selfish act in a lot of ways. But the successful artists that I know are all ones who take the business side very seriously and pay a lot of attention to not just like, what do I feel like painting today, but, you know, how will I sell this and how will I market this? And that's the reality of that whole business, you know, basically running a solitary little, you know, Joel Daniel Phillips LLC, you know, here I go. So, yeah. I'm very thankful for that. Looking back, it's funny to think about, you know, where would I be now if I didn't have that? I certainly would be in a very different space.
Yeah, it's an incredible project in and of itself. I love kind of the depiction of that line between the two and sort of the paths that are taken. It spoke to me personally as well, because my family diverged in a different way. My family diverged at my dad's generation. He was sort of the stepping away point by and large and kind of walking out of the lifestyle and cycle that his family was in. And so I've been kind of trying to follow in those footsteps, and it's very evocative of sort of the same idea with you and your uncle and things like that. So I really appreciated it myself. Great piece. Yeah. You mentioned painter, and of course you can work in whatever medium you want, but a lot of the work that at the very least I've seen and experienced until The Devils and most of the Lid Escalate projects as well have been in charcoal and graphite and pencil. Is that your preferred medium? What do you think about mediums?
It was for many years. I didn't paint at all until about 3.5 years ago. Maybe 4 years ago now. Most of my work over the past 4 years has been sort of a single body of work called Killing the Negative that's been exploring censored government photographs from the Great Depression. And that series started when I first started making it in 2020, in the same way that all of my work had been made up until that point, which was black and white, drawing, charcoal and graphite on paper. And I did, I think, the first exhibition in that series. It's now been like 4 or 5 different solo shows I've done. It was all black and white drawings. And when I was working towards my second show, I woke up one morning and I was like, man, I want these images to be red. I had this very strange like impulse that like, I need this image to be like in monochrome red, not black and white, from red. I started drawing them in colored pencil instead of in charcoal, and I hated colored pencil. It was just a weird medium. And so I eventually was like, well, shit, I guess I need to learn how to paint. I never even picked up a paintbrush at that point. And so I started the process of learning how to oil paint. And now it's been almost 4 years, and I've found that my preferred medium has shifted from drawing to painting. There's something about painting that's much more fluid and flexible than drawing. I think that's just because you can move things around on the surface and change things. And if you don't like something, you can paint over it or wipe it off. Whereas charcoal specifically is pretty soft and relatively forgiving, but once you put a black mark down, it's never coming back up off the paper. So there's something about the freedom of the process of painting that's much more attractive to me. But mostly at this point, it's funny, I've still only ever really painted in monochrome, you know, red. So a lot of my work is in sort of a red monochrome, and so it's in black and white as well. The Joe Abercrombie pieces were the first time I'd ever attempted to paint something in color, which was kind of a wild mindfuck to like wrap my shit. I have to figure out how do I mix colors? What happens if I put these two things together? Which, you know, like you're a kid, you're like, oh yeah, red and yellow makes orange, but like painting
something
like,
orange you want. Yeah.
You know, with how paints interact and mix and stuff. So it was a really fun project to dive into, because I was honestly terrified to start, because like, I don't know if I know how to do this, and I had to, you know, figure out on the fly kind of how to make it happen.
Yeah, I love those, and I definitely want to talk about those in just a minute. Before we get immediately into that, I love this shift of medium and the idea and kind of the direction that you're moving. To kind of realign ourselves in the timeline of your development, where did Lid Escalates come from? And then we'll kind of get into the fiction and the fun.
So it sort of, well, it started, I have to sort of start at the beginning. When I was first starting out, I think this would have been, gosh, when did Red Rising come out? 2011 or 2010?
I feel like it's 11.
I think it's 11. I think it was like towards the end of 2011 because
2014 was that? But you may have had a copy well in advance. Yeah. 2014.
That makes more sense. I was like, for where I was, and I wasn't, because I started out working with Pierce actually because he and my brother, my older brother, were roommates in college. He and I hit it off creatively, just sort of brainstorming weird, strange, nerdy things, sitting in my parents' backyard on when he and my brother like visited during college break. And by the time he got to the point where he was actually publishing Red Rising, which was in 2014, which I should know.
You're allowed.
He and I had created a collaborative kind of creative friendship, and he called me up and he said, hey, this book is getting published. I'd read the drafts and stuff. So it was a really exciting phone call. And he said, would you want to make some of the art for the book? And I was totally over the moon about it. As he'd been writing it, he and I had sort of, I'd been sketching some symbols, and we'd been playing around with, some of the color sigils and things like that. And so he asked me to come on board and help with that, and ended up, it was pretty funny, convinced Random House to hire somebody who had no resume and no portfolio and nothing going for them other than the fact that he was saying he wanted to work with this person. And they were no, which is very fair, because I absolutely had no reason that they would trust me. They have their whole own in-house team and everything, but he insisted on it. And so I ended up designing, all the color sigils and the house sigils and a bunch of other creative collateral for the first book launch. And that, then it was sort of off to the races from there. And around that same time, I was transitioning away from my graphic design background and work, and was starting my own career as a draftsman at the time. And so for several years, the only graphic design work I would do would be whenever a Red Rising book would come out, I would do the map and everything for it. And we didn't do anything with any of the artwork until, I think it was 2016, we did a sort of one-off Kickstarter, and Pierce, he is so generous and thoughtful. He was basically like, I know you got paid nothing for this, and now these books have an audience. Maybe we can sell some prints of the maps that you did. And so we did a Kickstarter doing some screen prints of the maps and a few other random things. And it, did really well. I think it was like $50,000 or $60,000 Kickstarter that we thought would do like $5,000 or $10,000. And that still didn't really kicked me into launching Lit Escalate. You'd think it would have at the time, but I was like, no, I'm focused on my painting, and that was fun. I got to pay off my car, great, And then fast forward another handful of years to COVID. When COVID first hit and everybody was sort of scrambling to figure out what are we doing and how do we respond to this, mm-hmm. I had a good friend who was down the street from me who had a screen printing shop who was really struggling to keep the lights on. It was sort of pre-PPP, and everyone was kind of panicked, and I was like, oh man, we did this Kickstarter and there was an audience, and I know in the Pierce's fans have grown even more since, like, maybe, we could sell face coverings with a howler wolf on them. And so we launched a fundraiser, sort of spur of the moment fundraiser, and slapped some House Mars wolves and some bandanas, and we ended up selling like $30,000 worth of bandanas. And we were like, whoa, what the hell is this, crazy? And that was a moment where I was like, okay, you can't keep ignoring this. There's this audience here, and I had a couple of friends who needed work. And so I was like, here, I'll hire you to, pack things, and you can help me ship things. And it sort of just built organically from there, where we were like, what else can we add? And what else do people want? And by the end of 2020, I think we'd done a couple different drops, and we realized we had to make it a real company and do all of that. And now fast forward another, gosh, it's been 2026, so 6 years now. It's
2025, thankfully.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, it'd be better if it were next year, frankly.
Lack of sleep here. Yeah, it's been a wild ride. We're working with multiple authors, and it's funny because it was never something I was like set out to do. It was sort of just the thing that organically happened, and I was like, had fun experimenting with, and now, 5 years in, it's something that's like takes up at least half of my time, you know, and I'm, you know, love every minute of it. It's been so wild and creative. And the fact that it would eventually lead to me getting the opportunity to make art for Joe Abercrombie, who's had been one of my favorite writers forever, is like kind of mind blowing because, you know, it was never like I said, it's from the beginning, like I was trying to walk away from graphic design and sort of that side of things. And yeah, but then to sort of organically fall back into it at a time when it was, you know, it was a thing that felt like it was needed to help my community, and then to watch that, you know, grow and realize, oh wait, maybe I do get a lot of creative joy out of this other side of the process. You know, maybe there's a lot more here and I can lean back into this and explore different creative pathways that aren't just fine art, you know, that aren't just work on a gallery wall, but maybe have a broader reach and a broader appeal to a wider audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you've accomplished that by and large. I mean, I'm wearing a Per Aspera Ad Astra. I'm rocking a little Howler logo on my little whiskey tin, which there's just a little bit in here.
There you go. I should have been with the studio today.
Oh, totally get it. I'm writing after this, so I'm totally, you know, interview and then I'm writing. So I'll get to channel the fuel somewhere else. So
there you go.
Yeah, it'll be nice. But that said, you talked about your introduction to Joe. Obviously, you know, you start with Pierce. We introduced V.E. Schwab a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, maybe. And then this year, Joe Abercrombie as an inclusion. What was your introduction to Joe? Not from the Lit Escalate side, but from books and everything else.
Yeah, the books. Yeah, I'd read the I've read everything he's ever written, I'm pretty sure. But I first was it was the first Law trilogy, I think, like most books. And I'm a huge fantasy buff, maybe even more than I am a science fiction buff. And
same.
Yeah, he'd been one of my favorite fantasy writers, you know, outside of, you know, like George R. R. Martin is the only person I'd say that, like, you know, I think does it as well as he does in the sort of gritty realist fantasy, which is kind of my favorite thing. You know, I've never been a huge, like, sort of swashbuckling swords and magic kind of fantasy fan, more of like a gritty realist fan. And so, yeah, it was. Just reading the books and I, it's funny, I actually listen to books. I don't even read them anymore because I don't have time to sit down and read mostly, but because I listen to audiobooks every day while I paint. And so
I was going to ask, that's gotta be hundreds of hours, right?
Oh my God. I mean, it's, yeah. My Audible library is probably like 500 or 600 books. And it's just been something I've done for years. And so I can say that I've actually, you know, consumed almost every fantasy property that exists and most, you know, classic and contemporary sci-fi, at least that's, you know, of a sort of reach to be on an audiobook. And I love it. I just, it's sort of my bread and butter while I'm working. I just, you know, turn on a story and I paint. And so, yeah, I listened to the first Law trilogy and I fell in love with the series. And so then I was so excited that there was a follow-up trilogy and then was delighted with the Shattered Sea series. And so when Pierce and I were first deciding like, oh, hey, maybe you know, this is working really well for Red Rising fans. Maybe we should talk about who else would be a fun fit, you know, for this thing. V.E. and Joe were the first two names that came up. And so that was a few years back. We reached out to Joe and at the time, he wasn't able to say yes because all of his merchandising rights were tied up into film projects. And so we were like, well, he was very receptive to the idea. We had a lovely chat. And so that started me once a year to sort of pinging him and going, hey, how's it going? Where are things? You know, I still love to work. We did for Pierce and oh, now we added VE. Here's what we done with VE. And, you know, so he was following along. And so very top of last year when I reached out to him, he was like, well, actually I'm just finishing a new novel and it's a whole new series, so there's no rights conflicts or anything, and maybe we should talk about this. And so I was so excited because, you know, my idea behind working with him hadn't ever been like, oh, I get to make the art for his books. That had been been like in my possible, you know, set of crazy things that could happen. It was like, oh, you know, maybe we could do some Logan Nine Fingers chaos or something. And yeah, naturally, which I still want to do, but yeah. So he you know, said to let's talk about this. And so that led us into, you know, the whole process of creating all the art for the book, which we can get into in a minute here. But yeah, it was very much, you know, a process of me sort of just like endlessly begging him until he finally said yes. It was really the reality.
Nice. I mean, persistence is key, right? Like that's a big deal, especially in spaces like this. I mean, it's easy to get distracted by a number of things. I remember it was maybe 2022 or something like that. You'd sent out a message to a group of creators within the space and you were like, who do you want? And I immediately replied, I think first line, Joe Abercrombie. And you were like, already on it, already thinking about it. And I was like, yes, all right. And now here we are, you know, many years later, finally having crossed that line.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, that was like, Joe was the name that popped up the most when we asked the Red Rising fans, like, who else would you be interested in sort of seeing this sort of creative chaos applied to? And it's funny. I think, if you like Pierce's books, you'll like Joe's books. You know, there's a lot of similar sort of gritty realism and also humor and kind of humanism pulled into it. It's, they're...
Yeah, they both approach history with a similar kind of bend towards story as well and kind of use it as the backdrop and facilitate the rest of the storytelling. So,
yeah, absolutely. The books aren't just like, oh, here's an interesting, unique setting and I'm going to, you know, tell it the stories of individual characters. They're like geopolitical in scope.
Yeah. Let's talk about the French Revolution in context.
Totally. Yeah. And like, let's talk about the Roman Empire and, you know, And that's for me what I think, you know, at the end of the day makes a really good book is books that are expansive and beyond just, you know, a small story that really get into the human condition and our history and our stories. And, you know, there aren't that many series that really do that well, you know, that are, cause it's a breadth of storytelling that I think is really complex and complicated. And, you know, both Pierce and Joe are some of the smartest people I've ever fucking met. You have a conversation. Like, oh my God, how do I keep up? Like, you're mentioning, you know, Roman togas in one sentence and then, you know, space fusion in the next. And you're like, how do you know all of this? Where does it inside your brain?
Yeah, contains no bounds, right? It just keeps going in every direction and whatever direction they're interested in.
Totally. Yeah. Very much like they're both people who I would describe as like deeply curious people, which is like a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think that's fundamental and important to a lot of art, right? You have to be curious about different things, different styles. And this stylistic shift that you made, what a transition, is one to something that's very different, right? It's very, I would say, almost like Byzantine in a lot of ways. I kind of saw the artwork that you did for these eight characters as sort of this fusion between the Bondione and Albrecht Dürer, right? Like there's a little bit of both of them kind of in stylings, I think, in different moments and elements between Byzantine and sort of Renaissance. What did you see as inspiration? What was sort of your driving point?
Gosh, it wasn't any particular painter as much as just sort of medieval portraiture as a whole. You know, I don't know, you know, I don't want to like spoil too much because I know there's actually not very much information out there yet.
It's very true. I had a hard time coming up with specific questions.
Not dropping any spoilers here. But you know, as you probably picked up, it's set in sort of a fantasy medieval setting. And it's actually a kind of realist setting in the sense that it's the backdrop, as you'll hear when you read the book, is this kind of, it's a schism between churches and power in that world, that medieval world. It's a very realist sort of backdrop to the fantasy world that the whole thing is based on. And that's as far as I can really go without giving any spoilers, but it's very much the backdrop to the entire book. And so when Joe and I were first talking about it, he sent me the manuscript and I listened to it on with like an audio reader, actually, that was like, cause I just had a PDF of it.
Uh-huh. So I've heard this horror story once before. Yeah.
British accent while I was painting. And I immediately was like, oh my God, I need to paint these characters as sort of like almost Byzantine saint icons. And it's actually kind of funny because my whole family is, my immediate family, my mom and my dad and my sister as well, actually have, I grew up in a fairly religious household, but it was like kind of standard Protestant non-denominational as a kid, and they have all converted to Eastern Orthodoxy as their sort of That's their Christianity of choice. And so my parents, when they travel, they actually bring with them these little saint icons. It's like part of the Eastern Orthodox kind of traditions and theology. These little icons are like these kind of, they're almost like meditation elements in you know, your prayer practice. And so they, you bring them with you and you travel and you, they're all over your house. And so I had been seeing them sort of around my parents' house. And I'm like, these are really strange and really interesting from a visual artist standpoint. I'm personally not religious at all. And so my own obsession with them was like, what are these weird little paintings? Because they're kind of hokey the way they're painted. They're just like, it's very much a purposeful philosophical way of painting. You know, it started in whatever the 1500s or something. I should have my
1500s, yeah,
you know. And so there's a lot of, I've taken, you know, art history courses talking about like, oh, what point do people start painting more realistically, and there's a lot, you know, of sort of agnostic conversation around why these images were painted in a certain way. But they were painted in a certain way from a religious standpoint, because it was supposed to be, you know, it was supposed to be a simplification of the human form that had you focus on their, like, the divinity of the saint. And so there's almost like a purposeful, it's not, I wouldn't call it cartoony, but like a simplification of the human form in those paintings, that
a literal caricature.
Yeah, it's a literal caricature. And it's sort of a beautiful philosophical idea, you know, that like, oh, we don't want to make this perfect. We want it to sort of be, or we don't want to make it as real as we could. We want to sort of have it be something else, and something a little almost heavenly about it, you know? And so it was me seeing those portraits around my parents' house, combined with then, you know, when Joe, I read the manuscript, I was like, oh my God, I want to do icon portraits of these characters. And I actually called up my aunt, who is also Orthodox, and she does icon painting. And I was like, how do you paint icons? And she gave me all of this information about the process and the history. And so when then I started making these portraits of each of the characters, trying to sort of connect to that style, but I didn't want them, you know, my first one was actually interesting. The first one was very much, when I was sketching them, super in that style, that was like very idealized, you know, not a lot of, you know, less sort of personal character and more like saint in each of the images. And he was like, we need more individuality. And so we ended up sort of creating this hybrid style that wasn't, you know, doesn't really look like a Byzantine icon painting, but has
evocative of it. Yeah.
Yeah, which I can show you a couple of. I've got some sitting here next to me, which this is the
incredible. I was going to ask if they were superimposed or how exactly that was captured. How the like wood grain, if you had painted it directly on wood or otherwise.
I painted it on board, and actually took each board and I covered them in gold leaf.
We're just snagging a photo. Don't worry about it. Totally fine.
So yeah. So the first step was I took a Bristol board and I covered it in gold leaf, and then I painted the whole thing on top of gold leaf. So you can see here how, like, even in the jacket, it's like the lines in the jacket are metallic. So I was sort of like painting over the top of the gold so that parts of the image would have actual gold coming through. And yeah, that was a process. And then it digitally then took that and placed it onto, you know, images of wood grain, because in the book, there's some of them are full color and some are black and white. And so, yeah, the white background was sort of me wanting just to have it just the character, and then I could figure out where and how we were going to place it digitally.
Awesome. Which ones ended up being in the end papers versus internal?
On the end papers, we have Alex and Sunny and Vigga and the priest. So that's Vigga's the werewolf image that you've seen. Yeah. So it's funny. They've like teased it, and I don't know how much.
I think they've shared a little bit on each character, so it's not fully.
Yeah, I'm like
included.
How, like, you know, the publishers tease out all the images, so, and introduce the characters. So yeah, they're both of those were specifically because they're sort of two character pairings. So the end papers are on one side. You know, you have on the front you have two facing pages, and on the back two facing pages, and so they were sort of two purposeful character pairs that interacted with each other in the book.
Cool. Awesome.
I haven't actually seen what they did internally yet. So,
no physical as of yet for you. No arc. Come on.
I've got an arc, but it didn't have any of the art in it. So,
well, yeah. I mean, that kind of makes sense, but also.
Yeah, I should ask them what they did. I'm curious.
Yeah, I'm sure you could get an answer. It's so interesting to take this adaptation process. I'm curious. Obviously, like you said, you kind of went back and forth. You took a couple of rounds on these. Were there any that stuck close to an original image or worked or less or more work that you had to do? I see Balthazar, for instance, the magician in this case. And that one is almost immediately reminiscent and looks like a first draft to me, or not a first draft necessarily, but, you know, like one that maybe didn't get respun. Yeah. Wow. Incredible.
Thank you. Yeah, it's pretty. So each of them, you know, the process was really fun. So the first step was, you know, I pitched the idea to Joe and he was like, oh, that's really fun. I love the idea. And so once we got the publishers to sign off on it, I had him send over a character description sheet where he had, you know, described the character and how he pictures them and pulled some quotes from the book and kind of wrote like, almost like you, if he was writing for a script or something, you know, what his sort of like take on the character. He even, for some of them, had notes on like, oh, you know, I picture them in my head kind of like this actor or this actor. And so when I was first starting out, I started making sketches. And so I think for like half of them, like for Jacob of Thorn, he's a Knight Templar. So find the image here.
The only one with a strong pop of white, like a different color among the rest.
Yeah, so here's Jacob of Thorn, and he's like a knight. He's a Knight Templar, this sort of grizzled, battered, ancient knight who's just sort of like tired of fucking
had it.
And so Liam Neeson was who Joe was like, oh, she could look like Liam Neeson. So I very much, you know, was looking at images of actual people to get a sense of, you know, facial structure, and, you know, it doesn't really look like Liam Neeson, but there's hints of him in there. And so the process was like, first Joe sent me this amazing document, and then I started making sketches of each. And I think we probably went through 3 or 4 rounds of sketches for each character where Joe would be like, I like this, I don't like that, and this is a little too, you know, first he was like, these are too cartoony and kind of too much like the same icons. We did a little more realism in there, and then, oh, that face isn't quite right. And I think with Viggo, we ended up going through 5 or 6 different rounds of sketches, because at first, when she's not a werewolf, she's like a Norse warrior character. And
tracks so with the name.
Initially, it was like, I wanted to do her as in her human form, and then we ended up being like, no, goddammit, we need a werewolf, an actual werewolf here. And so we ended up shifting gears and shifting to a werewolf. So, yeah, the process for each one was really fun, because it was like, make a couple sketches, send them off to Joe, he'd give me notes, I'd go back to the drawing board, bring those into the next draft, and once he signed off on the sketch, then it was actually painting them, which the sketches were pretty tight, but they weren't like super, super realized yet. So there was a lot of process. Like, he had really had to trust me to like turn these into something that, you know, wasn't just like a dopey little, you know, sketch. But yeah, it was really fun, because I got to really, you know, there's something about the creative process of collaborating with an author that's, it's like really freeing and enjoyable, because the world is already in their head. And my job as an illustrator is to figure out what that looks like and find out how to realize this world that is imagined already for them. And so it's not just my take on the world, but it's me trying to understand how they also see it and bring that to life. And so it's interesting, because as a painter, most of the time when I'm painting my own work, you know, nobody gets to tell me what to do at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's lovely and, you know, so, so great. But when I'm working with an author, there's this element of almost like, I'm almost like a co-pilot in some ways. Like, I'm not the decider of anything. I'm just trying to visualize their vision, you know, and that's really freeing, because it's almost like, I get to just step into a whole different world, and I get to, you know, try to figure out, you know, I know how I picture this character, but is that how they picture the character? And yeah, it ends up inevitably resulting in approaches that I wouldn't have initially taken, you know, and with all of the authors that I've had the joy of working with, the results end up being much better because of that, you know, because it's a true collaboration where they're like, no, that's not really how I think it should be. And maybe if we do this, no, have you thought about trying that? And, you know, yeah, it's really, a fun thing to be able to do.
I love that entire idea, and Viga in particular, with sort of the like almost wave, like the hand wave, just gives like a signature Abercrombie-esque flair of like, sarcastically, I might kill you, or, you know, like, am I threatening or is this funny?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the line I was trying to walk with all of them, where, you know, his books are like gritty and realist, but they're also based on this sort of dry British humor. Mm-hmm. And so like, your favorite character might die at any time, a horrible bloody death, and also it's somehow funny. Like, it's like the world, it's like, I don't know, there's something about, it's like processing trauma through humor almost, is what all of his books feel like.
Absolutely. Yeah, great way of summing him up.
I'm still alive.
Yeah,
and it's just so, there's something like profound about it, you know. I mean, there's, it's interesting, I think sometimes about like, you know, the Greeks had this idea of, you know, tragedy and comedy sort of being the alternate sides of the same coin, and sort of the two elements, the sort of root elements of the human condition. And there's something about Joe's work, and Pierce very much also does this too, where there's like, you know, like absolutely like gut-wrenching sadness in some moments, and then like you're crying laughing three pages later. And it encapsulates some sort of, it's a breadth, you know, of what we go through in the world as humans. Life is complicated and hard and beautiful and crazy and hilarious. And the, you know, it's like, you know, there's that kind of old truism, you know, I had to laugh so I didn't cry. But like Joe's books are like that a little bit, where you're sort of like, because it is brutal and it's heavy and it's hard, and but then it's also funny, you know, and it's like, and it, yeah. So that was it, that what I was trying to bring into each of the characters was sort of a mix of that, you know, realism, that kind of grittiness, with also a little pops of kind of humor for each. And the idea in and of itself, which is sort of hilarious to me, the idea of a werewolf painted, like a Byzantine icon painting of a werewolf, is just like funny. So
yeah, right. Innately, right? Even like a Norse person in context, you know, like a,
yeah, or a necromancer or a vampire, right. You know, yeah,
or Sunny, which is a very interesting painting and a very interesting choice.
I wish I could talk about that one, but I can't yet because you haven't read the book.
We'll follow up at some point. I sent them to my dad, of whom was an aspiring artist for a number of years and has done a number of paintings. And he was like, that's the one that calls to me. He was like, immediately, he's like, I want to know that. I want to know more there. And I was like, good call. Yeah, that's a good one.
Thank you. Yeah, that one was a kind of a hard sell. It was like, let's not paint someone
absent from the photo.
So yeah, TBD.
Mm-hmm. Walking off the page in a very interesting way.
I just don't remember.
Yeah, right. May, right? It's not that far away.
Yeah, a couple months now, May 13th.
Yeah, not too far. Where was I? We've gone through a number of these already, so I'm just kind of piecing through. There was one other question that I wanted to ask about the Devil's Foreshore. Obviously, you guys are doing the drop itself within Lit Escalates with a number of different pieces. Some have already sold out at the point of recording this. This is coming out tomorrow. So if you haven't, go check it out immediately. What were some that excited you in the creation process of this and kind of doing a book launch and book sell proper?
Yeah, it was fun to do work on the text and the like the bookmark, the calligraphy and stuff. I actually got to bring a friend of mine, Carl, who runs the Patreon for Lit Escalates.
Carl's great.
Amazing, like really loves medieval calligraphy. And so he actually hand did a bunch of the calligraphy. So yeah, it was really, the whole thing was kind of fun. It was a little bit chaotic because we kind of pulled it together, honestly, a little bit last minute on our end, because we hadn't initially planned on launching anything until after the book had been out for a while. Like, we weren't going to do anything with Lit Escalates until people had a chance to read the book, because we went, well, why would anyone buy anything if they haven't read
the book? Ahead of time.
You know, and then we ended up, we had a little bit of a scare moment where there was somebody, you know, we almost lost access to some of the merchandising rights for it because some exciting conversations were happening that I can't talk about, but luckily that didn't happen and we were able to move forward. But that was like, I was like, oh my God, wait, this book is so good. Somebody's going to try to, you know, do some of these. And if it's a big film studio, you know, why would
lock it in
access to these rights? So it made me just say, oh, shoot, I guess I have to, you know, speed this process up and dive into this, you know, before the book's even out. And so that was it was an interesting, you know, process to sort of think through creatively, because with Lit Escalates, everything we've ever done has mostly been around things that already exist. You know, there's an audience, they like a character, they like a quote, they, you know, it's already there. We're just figuring out what people want, and the book's already out there and there's a interest in it. And so figuring out how to sort of do what we do, but with a book that's not out yet, was really fun, because it's like, you know, a lot of what we've ended up doing for Pierce over the years as we've grown has been some of that, where we're working on building excitement for the new book, you know, and HowlerCon to giveaways for, you know, the books and stuff like that. But so to be able to do that for Joe with this, really specifically saying like, oh, you know, let's host our own presale for it, and you know, let's be Barnes and Noble here, but cooler. So
be cooler. Come on. Give yourself more credit than that.
and it really added my expectations. I had no idea how people would respond, because like nobody's read the book yet. And Joe's one of those authors that, you know, people really trust, because he doesn't write anything that bad. You know, everything's great. So I think it really speaks to the way that people connect with his books, that it has, you know, the response has been what it has been, because people are willing to buy something without having ever read the book yet. So yeah, I'm delighted with how it went so far. And if you were one of the folks who purchased, thank you very much. We live to drop another day. So
yeah, very true. I totally missed out on the like little Vega portrait similar to the icons, and I was like, shit, just kicking myself in amidst the rest. But yeah,
it's a fun one. We'll be doing, I mean, the idea with that is I'll eventually make one of those for each character. So
I kind of figured, I was like, I'll be able to, yeah, post reading, be able to pick the ones, you know,
you collect them all? We'll see. Yeah, I want every single one on my bookshelf. They're just so fun.
Very cool characters.
I step and I have, you know, idolatrous icons on the bookshelf.
They'll be like, wait a minute, this is not what I'm expecting. So we've been talking a lot about iconography and obviously the Devils. It's so exciting. I'm very excited as a big fan of Joe Abercrombie, Lit Escalates, and you guys and the whole, what you've accomplished over the years. I'm currently wearing a shirt, have a tin, you know, right here next to me. So I'm very excited for everything that you're doing there. I'm curious on sort of your thoughts on other iconography. Are there any other projects that you've considered or thought outside? Maybe not necessarily like authors that you're trying to court in the moment. You don't have to say anything like that. But are there any other sort of like dream projects and some like initial thoughts that you kind of have in that spectrum of things?
Gosh, there's so many. I mean,
of course,
a long list of authors that I would love to work with, not as long as maybe you'd think, but there's quite a few authors I would love to work with. And we've had to figure out, you know, how to grow quickly, but also kind of slowly. The process of working with an author, you know, takes a long time to sort of get off the ground. And so
they're also solitary by nature.
You know, but we don't have anyone sort of on deck at the moment. We've been pretty focused on getting Joe off the ground. But the person I've been thinking about recently that I would love to do something with is Dinnaman. Great Dungeon Crawler, Carl.
I am in the middle of the first book right now.
It's so fun.
But I'm enjoying it. Yeah, it's great.
And it's very different. It's
starkly.
In that it's not quite as serious, I think. It's very much, the tone is, you know, it's intense and bloody and, you know, and very adult, but it's not, you're not sitting there being like, you know, having a character worrying that your main character is going to totally die in the way that you do with like Pierce or Joe, which I think is for me the root of sort of realist fantasy or science fiction. It's like anyone could die at any time.
This POV could be gone. Ephraim.
Yeah,
totally.
I think like single POV books, you're sort of like, well, obviously what happens if the you know, the POV dies? You know,
a bold author switches.
Yeah. Anyway. Right? Like suddenly it's a new POV, which yeah. I've never seen anyone do that, and I would love to see somebody.
It'd be so cool. Yeah.
But yeah, I've absolutely loved, I think I'm on the fifth book right now. I've been loving that series. It's really fun. And it's like it's a unique world that's like, you know, there are certain authors, like Joe is one of them, who sort of, in moments, like the world sort of crosses over almost into science fiction or feels like it could. You know, there are elements in the Shattered Sea trilogy where you're like, oh, wait, this world is built on the aftermath of like a technological world, and like the elf bangle that this character has is just a watch.
Right.
And so there's like elements where that kind of like science fiction almost element pops in, but like Dungeon Crawler Carl is like a medieval D&D battle set in the space with
multiverse,
so like everything all at once,
right?
And I just like I love it as like a cultural mashup. I love it, and there's so much that'd just be really fun to play around with in that world. Who else have I thought about a lot? Gosh, you know, The Lies of Locke Lamore. Have you read that book?
I am also in the middle of that. We let patrons pay for us to like read and review specific books. Both of those are the two that we're reading at the moment for like specific reviews. So very funny that you call them out.
Absolutely love those books. Also a little bit.
Me too.
Less on the side, a bit more on the kind of, I don't know, humorous side, but really enjoy those books. Gosh, who else? I don't know. There's so many good fantasy books and so many good.
I mean, the entirety of like that beginning segment, even in Locke Lamora, is incredible that way and totally works. And I mean, Matt Dinneman, Princess Donut is begging for so much art.
Totally. Yeah, there's so much you could do. Yeah. Oh my God, so much. Well, it's, yeah, I don't want to spoil anything, but like, there's a very funny moment later on where like she gets like an action figure of herself. And it's just, I'm like, God damn it, I
want
to make.
I want that action figure.
You know, yeah. Like, that'd be so fun.
Very cool.
Yeah.
You know, beyond sort of the scope of things with, now that you've done book illustration, obviously you did it with the map, but a map is a map, right? A map is great. It's important to the story, but illustration is this way. Are there any books that you've considered that you wish that you could do art for, or that you wish you could be allowed to sort of like do a special edition of even?
You know, it's interesting, you know, it feels like something that maybe Lit Escalade should think about getting into is like doing special editions or something like that, you know, which would open up maybe space to do things like that. But, you know, the process of working with an author for a new book, you know, is one that sort of, at least in my experience, because I haven't pursued it as like my career, is not something that happens very often. You know, it's only happened for me so far with two authors, and I hope it happens more, you know, and as we're doing more of this stuff, I think, you know, publishing companies are starting to think more holistically about the marketing and the community building that goes behind, you know, creating a successful book series where it's not just like a few years ago, sort of like, oh, you buy the book, and then the way a publishing company sells books is a little bit of advertising at the beginning and maybe a few arcs. But mostly it's just sort of, you find it on a bookshelf or your friend talks about it. And now we're living in this wild world where, you know, there's all of these amazing small companies that have totally disrupted the industry. Everyone from The Broken Binding to Owl Crate and the Luna Crate and Fairy Loot and all of these companies that have like realized that fans of series want, you know, more. They don't just want, you know, the book. They'll buy a collector's version of a book, or they'll buy into a book subscription box. It has other illustrations and add-ons, and people want those worlds to be visualized. You know, people who read a book and like the book want more than just that book. And so, you know, it's been really interesting to sort of be a part of this world that's shifting so rapidly. Like the publishing industry itself is actually kind of on its heels a little bit. It feels like, in the sense that they suddenly are realizing that there's this massive part of the industry that they've never touched, where small presses and collector's editions were kind of their own thing for a while. And now it's like, oh, when somebody buys into a new series, they kind of expect a little bit more than just a book, you know, like they want it to be, you know, spray edges and, you know, have an opportunity for a collector's edition and, you know, things like that sort of are almost like the baseline now. And so, you know, as far as things that, you know, I want to sort of keep pursuing, it's anything in that space where, for me as a visual artist, I just get so much joy out of visualizing a world that has never been really seen. And any ways that I can do that and sort of bring people joy, because it allows, at the end of the day, it allows a fan a way to sort of talk about this thing that they love in a different way. It's actually really, it's a little a little bit on the kind of nitty-gritty side of the business, but it's really interesting. It's been really interesting to learn about the reason why traditionally book merchandising hasn't existed until relatively recently. And that's by and large because if a book sells enough copies, it will generally be optioned by a film studio. And an option isn't a promise to make a film. It's just simply a film studio saying, nobody else can do anything, and we're reserving the right to do anything for a period of time. And mm-hmm. So Pyrus has been sort of endlessly optioned, basically since Red Rising came out. You know, it's continually, and there's been a few different iterations of that, and, you know, I can't speak to any particulars, but, you know, and as are almost any books that even come close to the New York Times bestseller list, because that's sort of the traditional process. And then film studios will choose from this vast pile of options that they snap up once they find out whether it really hits a cultural chord. Who do we want to sort of move forward with? And okay, so somebody else is making a science fiction show, so maybe we don't want to compete with that, so we should do a fantasy show. Or, oh, you know, Game of Thrones is happening.
It's riding a wave, yeah.
And so the back end of that process is sort of Byzantine and endless, and it results in this wild scenario where most authors end up sort of in this Sisyphean loop of it's always almost happening, and maybe it'll happen, and it never, by and large, like very few properties end up getting actually made into anything, at least out of books that potentially could be made into anything. It's a very small percentage. And the reason that merchandise hasn't been a huge part of the fandom space is that traditionally merchandising goes as a right, it's purchased as part of the package with the option. So when the author signs, you know, saying, okay, well, maybe you'll do something, maybe you won't, but that includes that merchandising right. And so it's been really fun to watch that industry shift recently, because I feel like authors are starting to realize I don't have to sign that away, you know, and that I could do things outside of a film, and the audience is interested in more than just the book. And maybe we should be exploring other things. And, you know, for me as a creative person, that's just a really exciting space to be in, because it feels like there's kind of a sea change in the industry that's happening right now. And I get to be a little part of that, you know, get to, because, you know, I want to hold Darrow's razor in my hand, you know, like,
right.
Like, and who doesn't, right? You know, and unless somebody makes it, it's not possible, you know? So, yeah, there's so many worlds that I would just love to see realized, to see, you know, see that happen with. I grew up as like a major Tolkien nerd and, you know, had read the books before the movies came out, but then when the movies came out, was just like absolutely obsessed. My entire bedroom as a kid was like plastered floor to ceiling. Just from the movies, and I had Sting and Aragorn sword and all of that. And so, you know, it's funny thinking, oh, maybe my weird, you know, this whole thing kind of came out of that. Like, I loved
in the long run. Yeah.
I envisioned what it looks like. And then you got to see it on the film and then hold the thing in your hand. And you still love the book, and you get to watch that book become real, physical, you know, and that's something special. So.
Yeah, you're getting to, in a lot of ways, explore a space that they were like reserving the upside of, right? Like, that's basically the idea of that option. And so getting to explore something and kind of empower these fandoms to, you know, get the things that they're dreaming of and kind of fulfill that fantasy in a lot of ways, you're bridging that gap and also building up the fandom in a substantial context to where it makes sense to make a movie, where it makes sense to take some of these steps and jumps. So I find that very applaudable and laudable. So. Especially as an artist, you know, and kind of getting to explore that space in a way that is also interesting, and you take interesting turns, like the bust of Selenius. What a great idea. What a cool thing. I bought it for my dad. It's on his shelf. He loves it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. That was a fun one to like play around with. Cause I was like, I'd had this moment in my head ever since I read Red Rising where I was like, what if Darrow had found out that this whole thing he's doing is a lie, not by, you know, EO showing him and sort of that whole process that ended up happening. But instead, what if he was mining and stumbled on a buried bust of, like, you know, because Mars has been terraformed for 1,000 years, you know,
it's
this is new. And I had that idea. I was in Rome on my honeymoon, and I was looking at, I was in the Vatican and reading about the rivalry between Da Vinci and Michelangelo. And
good one.
It's such a fascinating history. Yeah. They were like artists and scientists and archaeologists and thinkers all at the same time. They weren't just like, oh, I'm a painter and my thing.
A true Renaissance man. Yeah.
They were really fucking good at that. But they were actually digging up Roman ruins while they were alive. And they were digging up and unearthing these sculptures, and they didn't actually know much about that history. At the time, they knew very little, and they were living on literally on top of it. And they would dig things up, and that would then inform their like contemporary creative and scientific discourse. And they would make these responses that were very much, you know, about like discovering this unknown that was right beneath them. And I don't know if you've ever been to Rome. Rome is wild.
I'm not yet. That's on the future checklist.
So yeah. Amazing if you're a history buff, because it's like...
Definitely am. Definitely need to go.
Layer on layer. And like, you literally, like in some of the museums and things you can go to, you can like see the strata of building. And like, there's one area in, I think it's in the Forum, kind of in the main sort of section of Rome that's still preserved and is now like a archaeological dig and also like public museum space. And there's a temple that is like, I don't know, 3 or 4 stories tall. And there's a door to the temple that's, when you're standing there now, it's up a whole story. There's an entrance door. And then the main entrance and the steps up are an entire story below that. But for like thousands of years, the level of the street had actually been built up so there was an entire story of the building had been buried. And so they made a new door in the side of the building. And during this entire time, this temple was in use in various ways. And then eventually they dug out around it, like in the 20th century, and realized like, oh wait, this entire building goes down a whole nother story on the outside, not just a basement. And that sort of idea of like what's underneath our feet, I don't know, I find that to be fascinating.
Very cool. And I mean, logically, it's so interesting. I grew up in Minnesota, you know, just as a side tangent here, moved to Wilmington, North Carolina. This is like Blackbeard's Coast and like a lot of the rocks that are just around the bigger building blocks are ballast that was on ships between here and England. And like, we have a similar thing with the roads where they've actually been going down and unearthing old cobblestone and just like letting that be the street in different areas. So I'm very appreciative of that. And the idea that detritus had built up over, you know, centuries and became this big, like whole thing. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks. The bones of the civilization before.
I just got stuck on that idea, and I was like, what if that's what Darrow found out? On this marble bust and deep in a mine. I'm like, what?
Are there any other cool dream projects like that that you're envisioning that you could maybe tease? You don't have to spoil, but, you know. Gosh.
Well, you know.
Like creative endeavors.
To be able to do my own Red Rising covers, which I've never seen. So that
would love that.
And I'm delighted to say that is happening.
Hell yeah.
Why, but that is in the work. So yeah, that will be announced actually quite soon. So that's something that's really fun, you know, that I've never touched in that space. Anything else that I can talk about? But we have some crazy things happening this year. So cool. Wish I could tease it, but I can't.
That's fair.
Get out of the bag too soon, but there's some pretty wild stuff that we're working on.
You'll have to come back to let that cat out of the bag properly and on time. We're a little late here, but
absolutely.
Yeah. So to kind of round this out, anything else about Lit Escalates or anything else that you want to talk about with the drop with the Devils? Are they all sold out now?
A heartfelt thank you to everyone who participated and allows us to keep coming up with crazy things.
Yeah, big deal and very excited. It was cool also to see Joe tout you guys as sort of the American special edition, you know, compared to the Waterstones, which is a primo comparison.
It was really fun. That was really fun. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, you know, he's publishing it's like Tor in the US and Goliaths in England, and then Waterstones. There's like, I don't even know how many different foreign markets are. I've already like sent over the artwork to at least 6 different foreign publishers as well. It's really fun to watch how much, you know, the folks in the publishing industry who've read the book are really excited about it. And so it's fun to be able to be involved in something that's like, oh my God, this is going to be
global,
you know?
Yeah.
And little old me had put art in there, which is kind of wild.
It's so cool. And I'm very excited for you. And having watched this journey over the span of since the start of this podcast 5 years ago because of Pierce Brown's work. So here we are. Now we're here. We're talking about Joe.
Here.
Yeah.
We'll go next. Who knows?
To round it out, unless you have anything else that you'd love to bring up, I'd like to end with like one cool recommendation that you have, piece of media, art project, book, show, anything that you've been enjoying most presently.
Oh, gosh. I mean, honestly, I already talked about it, but Dungeon Crawler Carl is like
fair
jam. And it's it's so funny. I feel like it's like one of those books that's just like, it's been around for a minute. You know, he self-published most of them. I think he's now with Random House, and it's just sort of blown up in the last 6 months, but like everybody I know is talking about it. But I hate to be, you know, bandwagon near, but it's fucking great. So that's my current rec, and that's what I'm telling everybody who asks what should you read next. And then obviously The Devils, because it's great.
Would you say May 13th? Was that the day?
8th. Yeah.
Cool. And I'm very excited.
I believe so. Yeah, that should be announced soon. So for folks who want to be able to meet Joe in person, there should be some opportunities.
Cool. Very, very fun. Very exciting. Dungeon Crawler Carl is great thus far from my own recommendation, but I'm excited to get that for the rest of this series as well. It's one of those weird things with Lit RPG where it's like, does this work? Will it work? But Jeff Hayes as an audiobook narrator, incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, Lit RPG, I also generally get annoyed by it very quickly because, and I'm not like, I've never been like a huge D&D fan or anything myself, although it can be fun. I'm not, you know, shitting on D&D people at all. It's just as a book, I found that often it ends up being a little bit rote and sort of like, into like the systems. And so I've really enjoyed Dungeon Crawler Carl, like walking a line between like telling a really unique story and also sort of relying on those systems, but you know, just does it in such a unique way that I don't find myself annoyed by like, oh, the character PowerPoints or whatever, you know?
And right. So
even if you are, dear listener, hesitant about Lit RPG, give Dungeon Crawler Carl a try.
Love that. Great pitch. Sweet. Well, I'm so glad to have had you, Joel. This was excellent. We'll definitely have to have you back for whatever future drop with The Devils. When you come back with all the rest of the iconography, the second book, whatever, whenever, you have a home here.
Great. I would love to.
And maybe PJ will be here next time. He got a day job, which is
as
damning. As one must. All right. Well,
thank you so much for having me. This has been a joy, and hopefully more soon.
And again, thanks so much for listening to the podcast. Just as a quick note, for next week, we are going to be getting into Becky Chambers and the Monk and Robot duology with my close friend Adam. We're going to be chatting about those two books. He's kind of leading the whole thing. It was a blast to record. I'm super excited for everyone to get to hear it. And then week following, likely Neil's follow-up, but I'll tell you, lean in on a little secret here. This weekend, we're recording the first episode of The Heroes again. So we're getting back to it, and we should resume shortly thereafter. So thank you so much for your patience, and thank you so much for giving, you know, PJ the space and everything else to do what he needs to and following along with the rest of these episodes. Thanks.